Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hello and welcome to Unheard. I'm Freddie Sayers. Like you, we are being inundated with information every hour about what is going on in Ukraine. And the challenge just to understand basic terms what is happening is immense because of the amount of propaganda and PR from either side of the conflict. That's what we're going to try to do in the coming days and weeks. We're going to gather voices and experts who can try to help us navigate between those poles of information and find out what is really happening. Joining us today is an analyst for the Stockholm Center for Eastern European Studies. He is an expert in contemporary Russian and Ukrainian history, politics, and regime transition. His name is Andreas Umland. Hi, Andreas.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
So you are a political scientist in contemporary Russian and Ukrainian history, specializing in regime transition. So it seems like you're exactly the right person to be talking to. You've been living in Kiev for 20 years and are currently in Berlin. In the past few days, there's been a couple of things that have surprised people. The first is that the expectation was the huge might of the Russian military machine would simply swoop in and there would be some kind of shock and awe victory. And it just took a day or two to understand that that wasn't really happening. How confident are you, or should we be in that? Because some people are saying this is all coming from Ukrainian sources. You know, we are essentially kind of repeating the propaganda from the Ukrainian side. Should we be skeptical about those claims of kind of bad outcomes for the Russian side? Is it possible that this is all part of a sort of two-week plan and that it's actually going okay for the Russians? What do you make of that?
I think in a way both versions are true in the sense that the Russian military might has not been fully used so far. And that may be also a reason why the attack so far has apparently not gone according to plan. And that may be connected to the Russian vision of Ukraine as a weak state and as a country where you actually don't need the full military potential that Russia has. And there's now those the expectation and fear that we may actually get a much larger escalation once Russia now realizes that this sort of small scale invasion is not enough to take Kiev and change the government in Kiev, and that we may now see a real large escalation of the war, which would be frightening.
So actually, what appears on the surface to be good news, which is the kind of Russian attempt is not going especially well, may not turn out to be good news in a few days' time if it's just a pretext for escalation.
Yes, especially the air power, the missiles, the artillery has been only used to a limited extent so far. There have been already some vicious attacks on civilian buildings, civilian areas in Kharkiv, for instance. Even the city center has been hit. But now that Russia or that the Kremlin realizes that it will not be easy actually to fight Ukraine, it may use these ammunition to much larger extent, and then we may get tens of thousands or even hundreds of thousands of victims.
So what is your best analysis of why Russia has been more cautious, let's say, in the early stages about using that kind of heavy military Is it because they just thought it would be easier and they didn't need to? Or do you think there is actually a sentiment within the Russian side that, given that the whole argument is it's part of Russia, that's their whole pretext for this campaign, to kind of actually shell residential areas and cause huge amounts of civilian casualties would go against the purpose of their own campaign? Do you think they actually are trying to minimize civilian casualties?
Yes, certainly they're trying to minimize civilian casualties because their aim is obviously to make Ukraine part of the Russian sphere of influence, maybe not to actually fully annex it as Crimea, but to have it in its sort of orbit in one way or another. So it would be sort of counter Russian interests to damage Ukraine to a large degree. The reason that also I think we've seen this hesitant attack on Ukraine is that also the Russian leadership may have been not only misinformed by its own propaganda and may have started to believe its own propaganda, but that there are also there have been also plenty of Western analysts who have been talking about the Ukrainian state as a joke, basically led by a comedian, corrupt, sort of as a bizarre, in fact, phenomenon where you just need to push a little bit and then it would all crumble. I know personally some of these analysts who have been spreading this sort of narrative about Ukraine. And of course, Ukraine is or has been corrupt. And indeed, the Ukrainian president was a comedian. But it now turns out that the Ukrainian state and the military and the society are much stronger. And if you knew Ukraine deeply and if you had studied, for instance, what has happened during the Orange Revolution, during the Euromaidan Revolution of 2013-2014, and during the last 8 years, you would know that the Ukrainians can get their act together if necessary. They may be not particularly strategic in their international behavior, but in situations of danger, they are actually quite good in improvising.
Let's dig in, if we could, to a couple of details that we've seen in the last 24 hours. So I think we have a map we can put on the screen of what appear to be the Russian areas of control within Ukraine. And they're kind of seeping in from all the sort of eastern front and the southern side, gradually encroaching on the country. It looks like they're about to connect the Crimean section with the mainland section that joins Russia. And then obviously they're coming down and gradually getting closer and closer to Kiev from the north. So while the narrative in the Western media is how poorly Russia is performing and how slowly and badly it's going for Putin, the map looks quite ominous for Ukraine because gradually they're being hemmed in.
Indeed, it looks frightening. But one could still argue that, what we are now observing is not something peculiar. If you look at the map of Georgia, it may still be the case that Russia is already still occupying more state territory of the Georgian state than of the Ukrainian state. That is the sort of sad sort of background story of all of that. We have seen this already on a smaller scale in Georgia without any sanctions, any serious sanctions, an improvement after this Russian attack on Georgia in 2008 with an improvement of Russian-Western relations after this attack in August 2008. And so we see here just a replay of what has happened already to Georgia in 2008 and arguably to Moldova in the early 1990s. So this is in a way nothing new, this map that we are now seeing. What I think here should be for European observers, also for Turkish observers, also for Russian observers, be the most interesting part in this map is the southern part and the little line there that says Zaporizhia. And that's because in the region of Zaporizhia, the largest European nuclear power plant with 6 active reactors is located. And we have now combat in the immediate vicinity of the largest European nuclear power plant. And I think that should change a little bit the perception of this conflict in Europe, because the stakes here are much higher than many people imagine. We are here in a risk zone that goes far beyond Ukraine.
One question I've had is how much we should put faith in estimates of casualties and losses, because the Ukrainian government has been very active in putting out daily updates on their estimates. And I believe we're currently looking at 5,000 odd Russian casualties, according to the Ukrainian government. And I'm not sure whether they are all dead or captured, but it's a huge number. And, you know, it's more people than died in 9/11. It's more people than the United States lost in the Iraq conflict. I mean, this is a big, big number. How much credibility would you give that?
There is now a website, a special website created by the Russian Ministry of Defense, where they're actually posting pictures of dead bodies and also of captured Russian prisoners of war with their names. This is actually made for the relatives of these soldiers in Russia. Although in Russia it's difficult to access actually this website because it has been blocked by the Russian government. But there is a documentation, even a already considerable public documentation of this number. Whether it's correct, maybe it's higher, maybe it's lower.
It feels fair to say, even if it's inaccurate by 100%, maybe it's half as many, it's still an astonishingly large number for day five of this campaign. There were stories that the Russian military is carrying with it incinerators so that they are actually disposing of deceased bodies so that they don't need to have the difficulty of bringing them home and having a ceremony when they land in Moscow. I mean, that's really a very grim thought, isn't it? And I just wonder, what is the politics of that likely to be within Russia? I mean, that's 4,000 or 5,000 grieving families. Will they have any kind of impact, do you think, on the perception of Vladimir Putin, of the whole project within Russia?
One would think so, although the portrayal in the Russian official public sphere of this whole conflict is, of course, very different from what we see. You know, it's a denazification campaign, a demilitarization campaign. No numbers yet, or very low numbers only, have been published by the Russian Ministry of Defense. So the Russian state has become very professional in sort of in shaping this public discourse. In general, I think over the last 20 years, the main thing that has actually happened geopolitically and the most frightening thing is the indoctrination of the Russian manipulation. So we've talked a lot about fake news in the West and sort of this sort of hybrid war methods. But the real frightening thing is how much the Russian population has been indoctrinated and is now believing these sort of stories about a threatening Nazi Ukraine that might attack Russia with nuclear weapons and stuff like that. So in this context, then the whole war is discussed. And of course, not much real information is presented.
I mean, we should say, shouldn't we, that there are Nazi sympathizers within Ukraine. I mean, it's not a fiction.
Unfortunately, in most Ukrainian, in most countries of the world, you know.
But there's been a kind of resurgence of nationalism, and some of these kind of more sort of self-governing military units are sort of neo-Nazi inspired. It's not a pretext. It shouldn't be a legitimate reason to invade a country. But on the other hand, we shouldn't totally pretend that's not true. Is that fair?
Well, there is a far right in Ukraine. It united before the last parliamentary elections in a united front, which is actually quite extraordinary for the far right. If you've studied it a little bit, they usually are not inclined to cooperate. But in view of the Russian threat, they united and they got 2.15% in the elections. They have now one female deputy in the Russian parliament, and the presidential candidate of the United Far Right.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
I got 1.6%. And that is actually below or far below of the results that far-right parties, sometimes singular far-right parties, receive in many other European countries.
So you reject the idea that there's a neo-Nazi problem in Ukraine, at least any more than there are in many other European countries.
Yes, yeah.
Let's turn, if we could, to the Western response to this, because this has been extraordinary in the past few days, hasn't it? And you're German, you're working at a Swedish think tank. Those two countries, having been neutral or steering clear of any kind of military engagement since the Second World War, I mean, we're talking an 80-year pause in militarization, have both now actively engaged in this, and both countries have sent anti-tank missiles and other munitions to Ukraine. Tell us about the historical significance of that.
Comparing the two countries, actually, I think that the change of course is more significant in Germany. Although Germany is a full member of NATO, for many decades already, had a very different strategic culture and was seeing itself as a sort of middle power that was sort of negotiating between the West and East, and had a particular relationship, a close relationship with Russia, a modernization partnership, a strategic partnership, all sorts of connections to Russia.
Energy and buying partnership.
Yes, and had also a sort of pacifist, economically oriented foreign policy or foreign economic policy. And now, since Sunday, when we had the debate in the German parliament, the Bundestag, and as a very surprising to me speech by the German Chancellor, Olaf Scholz, we have actually a very different situation now. I also think it's a deep change and it's a lasting change, because it's not only reflected in the speeches by the representatives of all the mainstream parties. Even the left party, which has been traditionally more pro-Russian, I would say, has now adapted its discourse. The only sort of apologetic party still remaining in Denmark is the far-right Alternative for Germany. But all the other parties have basically closed ranks. And not only that, also the population has actually changed. We had an astonishing change in the attitude of Germans towards delivery of weapons, which was, I think, still a few weeks ago around 20% support. And the latest poll I have seen, over 70% of Germans are now actually supporting delivery of weapons. So I think that is something fundamental.
Even recent campaigns in Syria and Libya and so on, the Germans have been opposed to being involved in that. And very recently, short numbers of years ago, and now that speech by the Chancellor, he says not only will they be rearming, they are going to spend more than 2% of GDP on military, which is what President Trump was calling for them to do for his term. Will we now see the, you know, engineering prowess of Germany, their Audis and Mercedes and Volkswagens, being turned towards munitions and military hardware? Are we going to see that for the first time in 80 years?
Well, that's going to be quite a feat for Germany, because our army is currently in a sad state, as you may have heard, in spite of all the image that public image that Germans have as good being good engineers. We have actually a pathetic army, and that needs modernization. And hopefully this will now actually be applied. I think that eventually the sort of rearmament of Germany is not going to play that big a role. Germany may still be hesitant to actually use this its weapons outside Germany. But rather, what I would see here as more important is the change in general geopolitical outlook, and also that this change is being now executed by a social democratic party-led government and a social democrat, and is also a social democrat that has had the sort of always the image of being moderate, balanced, restrained, a very unemotional, so to say, politician who has sort of in his unemotional way presented this this drastic change of German foreign policy doctrine.
So we've seen sending of munitions from all sorts of European countries. We have this incredible financial package of sanctions, which is really going to press Russia to the brink, it seems, an unprecedented package of sanctions. And now there's even talk of sending fighter jets to Ukraine, as many as 70 by reports. And apparently they're even going to be able to use Polish airfields to take off. This is a little bit concerning, isn't it? It sounds a bit like an escalation where it's no longer Ukrainians fighting, it's European powers getting involved.
Yes, but I think we should assess this here realistically. Often people sort of pretend to be realistic when they then warn about these developments. But what is often, what seems to be often behind that is, at least if you talk about the continental European powers and publics, is that there is a sort of, I call that galactic view of European geopolitics, in that many people think of Europe or imagine unconsciously, I would say, Europe to consist of two planets, a good planet, the EU-NATO planet, and the bad Eastern planet. And the problem is, however, that of course we are not on different planets, and there is not even a geographic sort of something in between Eastern and Western Europe. And so whatever happens in Europe has direct consequences also for the rest, at least, of continental Europe, and that therefore this sort of drawing this sharp line between the border of NATO and Ukraine, it doesn't make sense in my understanding. Again, I'm just saying what's going to happen if something bad happens in one of these six active reactors in Zaporizhia. You know, is the EU going to introduce visa obligations for nuclear particles trying to enter the Schengen zone, or what is the solution? We are here in a very risky situation anyway, and apparently Russia is going to increase these risks, and we are not going to be able to hide behind the European Union and NATO, because this is going to affect us directly. And if we don't increase the stakes for Russia, Russia will continue.
Is there not a risk of increasing the hardship on Russia so much and increasing the pressure on Putin so much that he feels backed into a corner? We know that he's isolated and maybe, you know, making unusual decisions. Does that not actually increase the risk on us of a kind of escalation that we don't even want to contemplate? Is there not some wisdom in saying we need to give him an off-ramp? We need to help Putin find a way out of this without doubling down and doubling down?
I don't think that one excludes the other. We should increase as much as possible the help for Ukraine, including military help, perhaps not direct military help, but indirect military help. And we should at the same time continue with diplomacy, absolutely. And we may even try to construct some sort of agreement that the Ukrainians would find acceptable, and the Russians could then find acceptable, and that Putin could perhaps even present as some sort of a victory in Russia.
I mean, what could that possibly be? We've seen the Ukrainian president. He's not going to accept anything short of full territorial integrity as it was before the campaign started and staying in power. And they're the two red lines for Putin. It seems quite hard to see what a deal could be.
I could imagine something like basically returning to the status quo before the attack, with a sort of recognition of the status quo, perhaps added with some sort of formulation about a future NATO membership of Ukraine that could sort of take, in a way, care of Russian concerns that could be presented as a victory, perhaps combined with the EU membership perspective for Ukraine. Ukraine would also get something in exchange. But for that, we need to increase pressure and the risks for Moscow. We cannot simply hope on some sort of acknowledgement of or some sort of turn of in Moscow. You need to actually you need to put up a fight. That is the sort of street fight logic that Putin is having. He's behaving like that exactly because the West and Ukraine are so weak. The most Russian city outside Russia is not actually located in Ukraine. Many think that is Sevastopol. The most Russian city outside Russia is on the Russian-Estonian border in eastern Estonia, which is the city of Narva, which has more Russian and Russian speakers than even Sevastopol. And Narva is secure because Narva is protected. There's NATO, there's the EU, the stakes are very high. And that's why Narva, which is, by the way, only about 135 kilometers away from Putin's birthplace, St. Petersburg, is in a good situation. Because the stakes would be very high for Russia to escalate there. If we increase the stakes also in Ukraine, then Russia will back down.
So you've painted what might be an optimistic picture of the likelihood of some kind of deal coming out of this, and maybe there is a diplomatic solution. It would be remiss of me not to ask what the more pessimistic outlook might be. Let's say that they don't come to a deal. Let's say that the European powers keep on upping the stakes and providing more military assistance. I mean, we know that pretty much everyone in Ukraine has got a Kalashnikov if they want one. We have Russian troops gradually advancing. We have a 40-mile-long column of tanks and carriers moving in towards Kiev. What are we facing if there is no deal, do you think?
Tens of thousands, hundreds, even hundreds of thousands of dead people. And again, this is not just about, you know, being very sad for Ukraine. I keep mentioning the four nuclear power plants in Ukraine and the 15 active reactors there. This is nothing where we can sort of imagine this being on another planet. This is on the European continent. The cruise missiles, Russian cruise missiles, are now hitting locations that are just 90 minutes flight away from Berlin. So this is all very close, and we have to then, what I've been arguing already since 2014 is to simply stop Russian energy. We stop paying for Russian energy deliveries, and then this would, of course, be costly for the West.
Are we still paying for Russian energy deliveries today?
Yes, of course. For gas, for oil, as far as I know, even for coal. So millions of euros are still going to Russia and financing. This is the odd thing, this war. And the war, again, which is in the immediate vicinity of the largest European nuclear power plant. This is such an absurd situation, in fact, that we should be actually talking about Ukraine in terms of the national interest, the basic security interests of EU citizens.
Andreas Umland, thank you so much for sharing your analysis with us.
Thanks for having me.
That was Dr. Andreas Umland of the Stockholm Center for Eastern European Studies. He is an expert on Russian and Ukrainian politics. He's lived in Kiev for over 20 years, although he was talking to us from Berlin. His analysis, I felt, was surprisingly optimistic. He seems to think a deal might yet be struck. which could look acceptable both to Vladimir Putin and to the government in Kyiv. Of course, it remains to be seen whether he's right on that, and I hope he is. In the meantime, we will be paying close attention and will be bringing regular updates with experts and analysts, as well as voices on the ground here at Unheard. So thank you to him, and thanks to you for tuning in. See you next time.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.